podcast is just a waste of time. I'm skipping through them, I'd rather listen and change my mind. Wes and Nick always help me through my daily grind. Your favorite guys, your favorite lines, change my mind. I swear these other podcasts are just a waste of time. I'm skipping through them, I'd rather listen and change my mind. Wes and Nick always help me through my daily grind. Your favorite guys, your favorite lines, change my mind.
Yeah.
And welcome back to another edition of the Change My Mind podcast.
I won't change my mind because I don't have to, because I'm an American.
Yes, you are. And I'm Wesley Sykes. And through the other side of the ether is the Fade Rotha to my beast Rabin. It's Mr. Nicholas J. Esk Fryer, hearkening for hire.
I can't believe you just did that to yourself. That's rough.
I would probably be the one to more lash out irrationally. Of the group here. That was my thinking of it.
Got it. Okay. That's fair. Okay. But that guy got totally, I mean, geez, Dave Bautista, that's a tough look for you, man.
Yeah, Beast Verbon didn't, you know, you don't really see, you see how crazy he is and how aggressive he is. He's kind of like, you know, like a middle inside linebacker type from, you know, like the 80s football day, 80 football movies. He's like a real crazy guy. Mm-hmm. But you don't really see him in action in Dune 1. You
no.
kind of do, but it's a lot of him yelling and everything, you know?
Yeah, really got watered down.
He's
not
really
watered
a big
down.
Baby.
Not played down just in general. But, I mean, that just seems it seems like where the character had to go. And then, obviously, he gets worked by Josh Brolin in this, which I love that. But we'll get to that more later. I'm getting ahead of myself.
A little bit, but it's all good stuff here because this is a movie that I think we can both safely say we really enjoyed. And without further ado, this week we are reviewing the latest Denis Villeneuve movie, Dune Part 2.
Do you have a sounder?
Oh, that's not playing, huh?
Oh yeah, no, that's not playing. I thought like
it's just playing through my headphones. I didn't have it going. So that's too bad there. Anyway, just picture like desert Arabian cries, you
got
know,
it.
That sort of thing. That's what was playing right there. But Dune 2 starring Timothée Chalamet and Zendaya. But before we get to that, Nick, and we're on we're making good time here. When was the last time you burnt the roof of your mouth?
I don't know if I can answer that, but what I can tell you is the food that causes me to burn the roof of my mouth the most.
Frozen pizza.
Just pizza in general.
Why
are you asking this question? Is it because of frozen pizza?
No. This was because I had a microwaved egg roll, Southwestern egg roll that was left over Sunday, like mid-afternoon, mid-morning, like 11, 12 o'clock or so. Folded up in a paper towel so it gets nice and warm, you know, kind of gets the heat trapped into itself. Only put it in the microwave for 30 seconds. Take one bite out of it, squirts out the other end out of my finger, burns my finger.
Nice.
And then the whole roof of my mouth is burnt right now. And it's like, that has to be up there. Burning the roof of your mouth has to be like one of the top five nagging minor injuries that just really bother you, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The other two that come to mind are paper cut, which I don't want to jinx myself. I don't want to, but paper cut and then
been on a good streak.
I'm in toe stubbing. That's the other one too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, what would happen to me a lot is when I had a shittier bed frame that would kind of like, you know, that would like, it's like a one size fits all bed frame. So you would get that like metal corner that kind of sticks out at the edge there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just tearing up your shin every day.
So there's those three, throwing the burning the roof of your mouth and then leg cramp too. You see a ton growing up, right? I couldn't give you a fifth one off the top of my head though, but there's four right there. There's your Mount Rushmore.
This probably falls within the umbrella of burning the roof of your mouth, but cutting the roof of your mouth, you mentioned like pizza or anything like that kind of being a culprit, but like Captain Crunch hard cereal, you know, that would always cut up the roof of my mouth, and I couldn't do that. Just too bad because the captain's great.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. I can't empathize as much, so I can't say I've had that happen maybe more than two times. But
I like to shovel food in my mouth, so that's probably what I run into. The more I can get into my mouth, the better it tastes.
I will say, like, biting your cheek or your tongue, that's my fifth one. That's in there as well. That one, of all the things, that's the one that probably still pops up on me with some level of frequency.
If I am to bump my head for whatever reason, I'm in a, you know, tight space, maybe I'm doing some work around the house, or something falls on my head, like that's like instant anger. Like I want to hit someone, you know, like it could be no one's fault. It could, you know, maybe my own fault. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's a complete accident or something falls over. And if it hits the top of my head, like that's like, I go psycho mode. I start seeing red, you know, it's like the Bitcoin memes where you see people with like the laser eyes. Yeah, like that's me at that point.
That's from Bitcoin? That's what that's from?
Yeah.
I had no idea what the hell that was from.
Yeah, it was like a crypto thing. Maybe not Bitcoin specifically. Gotcha. Yeah.
But basically you're the Adrian Beltre of the DSG is what you're telling me.
Yeah, don't touch my head. Yeah, exactly.
There we go.
Or good Chris Paul. I think Chris Paul has got a thing with his head.
Does he?
I remember something. I think it was... maybe Tim Duncan would like pat him on his head. Like the big men would do that and he would get really bothered by it.
Huh. Interesting. I think it's Chris Paul.
Yeah.
Yeah. Could be. I just didn't know. Adrian Beltre is just like cartoonish about it, how mad he gets. It's so funny.
Absolutely.
That like, how do you not want to do it to him?
No, you're asking for it at that point, right?
Yeah. 100%.
I think they did do that. At least when he was on the Red Sox, every time he hit a home run, they would like pat him on the head.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Poppy tried to go in for it a few times. God, he's a beast. The fact that he only played for Red Sox for a short bit is ridiculous. But anyways.
It's a damn shame. It's a damn shame. But you know it's never a letdown or a shame? It's the comic book minute. It's coming at you right now. Ooh.
Ah, a superb choice.
Big week for Marvel readers. Ultimate X-Men issue 1 is out. We also got Spectacular Spider-Man issue 1. And I was just, you know, perusing the interwebs before the show. And the Ultimate Universe in Marvel is making this comeback right now. Ultimate Spider-Man sold like hotcakes. I think it's this week, actually. I think it's this week. They have their third printing of Ultimate Spider-Man issue 1. It's that, like... that desired. Joe's reading it, loved the first issue, loved the second one as well. The Ultimate X-Men is by Peach Momoko, and she's a huge deal. So I would think it sounds like this is going to sell out pretty quickly at that first issue. That first issue. I actually did get a chance to read Spectacular Spider-Men and enjoyed it. I don't read a ton of Spider-Man stuff, and this is Miles Morales. Peter Parker, buddy cop in it, and trying to live like normal humans, and they just can't. So I had a good time with that. DC, we got The Batman First Night issue 1. This is actually current creators and turning back the clock, going to an original old Batman story and giving it a new, more modern look in modifying it a little bit for the times, but still it's set back in the past. AWA, we got Red Light issue 3. Mad Cave, we got the fifth issue, the penultimate issue of The Devil That Wears My Face. And we actually had the artist of this series on TLDR a little while back. And he's actually a relative of Uncle Buck, who some may remember from Hashtag Mork Barstool back
then. Barstool, like original Barstool, yeah.
Yes. So, it was a fun time talking with him. And then on TLDR this week, we only have What's New Right Now. That may mean some other stuff is in the hopper, but nothing's in the can, so I gotta I don't want to jinx anything. Also want to mention we got we're inside of a week pretty much left on the campaign for the Kickstarter that I'm involved in. Scott Snyder's writing class, you guys may have heard Scott Snyder mentioned a time or two across the DSG. For those who don't listen to any DSG shows besides ours, he is best known for being one of the best Batman writers of all time. We put together an anthology, and it's going to be a quarterly series, and that has already been fully funded. The first issue, Wes has gotten a look at it himself. If you want, the only way, as far as I know, the only way you're going to be able to get your hands on it is if you go and back the Kickstarter, and then we'll get that at some point later on down the line. I don't think there's going to be any other way. So if you guys want to check it out, I have the first story in this issue. If you have questions about it, you can always find me on Twitter at fry_guy1. But it's a successful campaign and got a little bit left to it.
It's campaign season, so I'm happy that this campaign is ending on a high note here. And I can't wait. I'm excited. I got my hard copy purchase, so I'm waiting. I'm excited for that to get you know, as veteran newspaper guys here, you know, I like the feel of it. You know, I want to be able to turn the pages. So,
yes,
very excited for once that hits the mailbox there. But very exciting stuff nonetheless, you know.
Yeah, I appreciate it very much. Thank you. It's almost as exciting, not quite, but almost as exciting as our topic, our main topic today.
Yeah. Are you ready to go talk to him?
I am.
Yeah. Tommy, are you ready?
All right. Now let's go get him.
All right. Love the enthusiasm out of Tommy here. We are talking Dune Part 2 and Exit Survey. Nick, what's the synopsis here?
Real quick before I say that, I almost feel like would Dune Part 2, like with Joker, would that sound, that sound better to you or does it sound worse when I said it? Dune Part 2.
What is, does it sound worse when you say, or what, does it sound worse than what like Dune Part 2 is?
I'm when you first heard me say it, did your stomach kind of turn a little bit, or did you think, oh yeah, actually they could have done it that way and it would have been,
you know, I don't, I'm not sure if French is you know, the right mm-hmm. dialect for you, you know.
Yeah, thank
I can't talk, I can't do any sort of accents or anything like that, so you know, we might be in the same boat there, but yeah, you know, maybe give it some effort.
Okay.
a little more, you know, take a couple more hacks at the plate.
I'm working on my Portuguese, so I'm just gonna I'll take the L on this one. Yeah. But well,
they kind of have like a jumbled type of like diction too, don't they? Or is it a lisp? They kind of have a lisp.
No, that's more.
Is that Brazilian?
That's more Spanish. Brazilian's more nasal, and then European Portuguese is more like, I think guttural is the way that it's described.
It's like more from the throat, like jow, yeah, and like, yeah, stuff like that.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah. Not that my Portuguese accent is perfect, but it's better than it was in high school. Anyways.
All right. I love it.
He's quitting French as of now. As for the synopsis for Dune Part 2, Paul Atreides unites with Shani and the Fremen while seeking revenge against the conspirators who destroyed his family.
Yes, this is directed by Denis Villeneuve, starring Timothée Chalamet as Paul Atreides, Zendaya as Chani, Rebecca Ferguson as Jessica, Javier Bardem as Stilgard, Josh Brolin, which I was surprised that he made, he was in this one here, playing Gurney Halleck, Austin Butler as the aforementioned Freyd Rotha, Florence Pugh as Princess Irulan, Dave Bautista as the aforementioned Beast Raban, or Rabin, Christopher Walken as the Emperor, Leah Seydoux as Lady Margot Fenring, Stellan Skarsgård as Baron Harkonnen, Charlotte Rampling as Reverend Mother Moyham, Suella Yacoub as Shishaki. I don't even know what character that is, so I'm not sure why that's in there. Roger Yon as Lanville, Babs Alasanmoken, as Jamis. Mm-hmm. Jamis, Allison Halstead as Maker Keeper, and Gisu Murley as Reverend Mother Romalio. Yeah, that was tough.
Yeah, we're gonna say a lot of these characters' names wrong. There are some tough ones in there.
Mm-hmm. Don't even ask me to do, like, I got it in my title, but the Lisan Al Ghib and the Moadib and like all that stuff, like that was, I'm never gonna be able to pronounce those. So that was my best shot at it.
That's probably the toughest part of all this, is keeping that straight. At least with some of these characters, it's like, you know, like we have the Atreides, we have Harkonnen, we have the Fremen. Like we know they're like the parties, at least.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, it does get a little complicated, but that's not on the movie, that's just on the book.
Yeah, and it was also like the Fremen term for Messiah was the Mudid, something like that. And then the Fremen name for the desert mouse was something also like that. They're very similar. And that's all what they're referring to Paul as when he takes his name.
Whether
he's the Messiah, or that's like part of, you know, the part of the name that he's given after he becomes a Fremen warrior.
I know the mouse thing with the Fremen war, and I know the game with an M. I thought the one that, like, the L name was
but they also called him the Majid or something like that, and that's also the Messiah term.
Oh jeez, I thought that was just the mouse thing. Okay, anyways, trying to keep on. I know we have the general concepts.
Yeah. We got it. We got what's going on here. We did the research.
For sure. Box office and critics reception, obviously, it's killing it. Brought in $178.5 million worldwide in its opening weekend, including $81.5 million domestic, and that's just, so it's just getting started. An even 9 out of 10 on IMDb, 94-96 split on Rotten Tomatoes, 4.7 out of 5 on Google reviews, and 95% of Google users like this movie.
Yeah, and this seems right because, you know, they didn't greenlight Dune Part 2 until after Dune 1 came out. So they wanted to see what the reception was and how it was received and everything. And then they greenlit Dune 2. And I feel like that's going to be the similar format for Dune, which I think it's called Messiah, the third one. That's at least the next line in the book series. Mm-hmm. And this seems like with $180 million worldwide debut, I got to imagine this has some box office legs, you know, people going back for the third time or just going for the first time, through word of mouth. I got to think that number, you know, gets them green lit for the third movie now.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up because I remember seeing some, you know, just looking on Twitter and obviously everybody's talking about Dune right now. Everybody's been talking about Dune probably since Thursday. And I noticed there was somebody talking about like how, oh yeah, if Villeneuve can like put together the right script and everything, then we'll get moving on the next one. It's like, wait a second, what? Like, yeah. I understand, you know, profits and everything matter and whatnot, but what do you mean? Like this shit's amazing. The first one was awesome and this one's better.
Yeah, I don't think there was even much time between the opening weekend release. That was a day and date COVID release on HBO Max and theaters. But I think it maybe lasted a week before they came out and said, all right, we're getting Dune Part 2. And I don't imagine there will be much time before they announce it between, you know, the initial release date and whenever they announce it.
Yeah, it's the fact that I just don't get how the fact that it's even a question like that it was at any point, like after the first one. I get it after the first one. Okay, fine. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm still kind of surprised, but whatever. Anyways.
I don't know. They give money for Madam Web and then they hold out stuff. You know, they keep you up in the air with stuff like this. So
yeah, it's only for Sydney Sweeney to go and drag it on SNL.
Yeah. But you know, hey, that no, all news is good news, right? So at least they're talking about it. At least it's still staying in the national conversation.
Sure.
By the way, her yabos were all over my Twitter feed. Just that Sunday morning after SNL, every photo and clip of her. Yeah, maybe that's giving away some of my algorithm a little bit there, but I was blown away.
Yeah, they people were excited about Sydney Sweeney being on SNL. Apparently,
she's got there's some talent there.
Okay. Look back at my Madam Web review. She was not good in that movie. She can make fun of that movie all she wants. She was not good in that movie. Like
She's very talented.
I'm not saying anybody was particularly good except for one character, but she was like, it was surprising how bad she was in it too.
I don't know what you're talking about. She's very talented.
Okay. Got it. Do you want to get to our tweet length
review? What is the score in tweet length review?
Okay. So I give this a 97 out of 100. Nice and simple. It was an amazing experience. The story, the characters, the cinematography, what a fucking ride.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm right there with you. Short and sweet. 98 out of 100. An incredible movie-going experience filled with a great story, performances, great cinematography. Denis Villeneuve adds to his stellar resume and the young stars of this movie. It's interesting. Like this is going into my tweet thread now review, but you got this like kind of old guard of established actors and actresses that Denis has worked with previously. Josh Brolin, Stellan Skarsgård, you know, all of these guys who are kind of up there. And they've all kind of made their name for themselves already. But then you got this young cast who is all famous in like Chalamet, Austin Butler, Zendaya, Florence Pugh. But this feels like this is a tentpole movie for all of them.
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing to say.
So I think that's kind of like ushering in the next crop of like young Hollywood stars.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a fair way to put it.
All right, now we get down to the nitty gritty here on the exit survey. Sure. Nick, did you fuck the popcorn bucket?
Oh, wow. Honest. They didn't have it at my cinema, actually.
Oh, so it was sold out already. Yep.
I mean, either that or maybe they didn't. Is there a chance they didn't get it, Wes? Because I went on Friday night and I went at 6:40. So I saw one of the relatively earlier showings. Okay. Should have been available, right?
Yeah, you think so. Maybe you know, you just got to show like your bottle of personal KY lube or something like that to get it. But you didn't have popcorn though.
Oh, I had popcorn, but they didn't have that. They did not have that like container. I actually was looking for it. I was just because
was this at your local Chunky's or was this more of at like a multiplex?
I did not go to Chunky's. It's Apple Cinemas in Merrimack, and it's like a chain in some capacity. I know there's another one. So
I wonder if it's just like for AMC or Regal or something like that.
Ooh, that's an interesting point. It might be. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure. But yeah, that
this is disappointing. Now you're gonna have to go back and just buy a ticket and be like, you know, just give me the popcorn and just get out of there.
Did you get the popcorn bucket?
No, I did not. Let me know what you think about this as a movie going snack. Beef jerky.
It's an interesting choice. I don't know. I don't think I would do that. It's like you're asking to get, but at the same time, do you run into like, do you get, I know it's goo has like the issue of like having in the movies, like having to go to the bathroom in the middle of it.
Sometimes I do. Yeah, it depends, okay. You know, but this one, I went to the bathroom beforehand and then had to go, but didn't have to go enough to where I had to get up and leave.
Wouldn't beef jerky help with that? Like not needing to go as much? Am I making that up?
Maybe. I mean, it's salty, you know, so maybe that dries you out a little bit more. Yeah. But my thought process is like, I saw the movie 8:45 on a Saturday. I was coming from Hyannis. I was working a show with my wife. So we came home, dropped the baby off, and then I've rushed out to go make the movie in Kingston. Which is probably like from Hyannis to Kingston, like an hour drive total. So I didn't really, and I was out, you know, like I said, was on that, helping out with that show for like all day Saturday. So I didn't really get to eat anything. And I didn't want just candy. And I didn't want popcorn. Like that's not really a meal. So I wanted like some protein.
Okay. Then that
was my thought process behind it. Like something that's a little more heartier.
Context is always important, and that makes a ton of sense. That is even a reasonable move.
Even without the context there, I just like beef jerky. It's a nice, you know, road trip snack, and I think for that, it also works as well. I think get some jerky next time you're at the movie theater.
Yeah, definitely for a road trip too. Of course, it's like, you know, one of the staples.
Was this better than Dune 1, Nick?
Yeah, so you had, when I saw that question, I was like, oh, I got to check my score, but you already did it for me. And I gave the original Dune 1, not the original one from like the 80s. Sure. I gave this an 88 out of 100. I still feel comfortable about that grade. Maybe I could go up a tick with it, but this was like comfortably better than the original Dune. And not that the first one was bad. It's just like, I mean, 88 is a great score, but this was just an amazing buildup the whole way through. But did you feel the same way?
Yeah. So I gave it a 90 first time go. I actually rewatched it this past week in advance of Dune 2. Nice. And it still holds up. I think the biggest gripe that I had with it is, you know, it's just a lead into this movie. So, yeah, it's like you had to wait the whatever it was, two or three years until this movie came out there. But the 90, I think it holds up. And also, I was really just, I asked Goo this because he got the advanced screening. So after I finished rewatching Dune, I remember having the same gripe when I watched it initially. They make all this talk about the sand walking in the first one, and they never show it at all. Everyone's just walking normally on the sand. Mm. So I was like, what's up with that? They made it a point to like show Paul learning about the sand, the Fremen sand dance, sand walk, whatever it was. And then I was pleasantly surprised in Dune 2. Like, it's all over this movie. So
yeah, it is.
I'm happy they brought it back up there.
Interesting that you still had that same gripe. Like, I respect that a lot.
Yeah. It's something that didn't age. And I remember thinking, I'm like, I think I had the same issue there.
How about that?
With Dune 2 now out, how does this stack up to other, you know, high fantasy, sci-fi epics like The Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, Star Wars, things like that?
So looking at just that list, it's still like this needs to still be finished. They still need to land a plane. And I think Game of Thrones is a great example of why that's the case. Mm-hmm. For me right now, this is trending to be on par with Lord of the Rings, which for me is the highest of the bunch.
Yeah.
I go Lord of the Rings, Thrones, Star Wars, like the original Star Wars, and then and then Harry Potter. And I know with Thrones, like it didn't land the plane, but the original Star Wars is like it's I love it, but it ain't perfect. And also, I feel weird about putting I'd feel weird about putting Thrones and Star Wars ahead of Dune when Dune is so good and Dune has heavy influences on both of those properties. Harry Potter and Lord of the Rings, the same kind of deal. So I get it. Like they're all their own thing and they're all really impressive and cool. And I love them all. And there's no such thing as an original thought anymore and whatever, but still like,
I wonder if there ever was,
I just want to point those things out. Yeah, for real. Well, I just want to point all that out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I got Game of Thrones at the top for me, just because like I agree the ending wasn't you know what I wanted it to be, but people say the same thing about Sopranos, and you know the ride and the world building and just getting immersed into that, like again the world or the culture of Game of Thrones, I was fully obsessed with. You know, I was about as close as I was to like picking up like a large anthology series like that and actually starting to read the books. Wow. Because I was so into it, but I never got there, but I was close. So I think that deserves some credit.
I've heard it is Tolkien is a lot, but I've heard that Thrones is,
it's very dense. Yeah. Very dense reading there. Really and I, you know, this is really just kind of pick your poison here. Cause these are all great high fantasy like epics.
Yeah.
There, whether it's the first Star Wars, trilogy, Lord of the Rings, or Dune is trending that way. But I think, the first Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, I think any one of those three could be the top. And Dune is trending that way, you know, depending on what happens with the trilogy there. Harry Potter is great, a special place near and dear to my heart. But again, it's not really a trilogy like the other movies are. This plays out over, you know, 7 or 8 movies.
Oh, that's okay. You know, I was curious.
Yeah. But it's also like more childish. Everything else has higher stakes, it feels like. Obviously Harry Potter at the end, but you know, you got to go through those lean child years at first. Mm-hmm. And then the other two trilogies from Star Wars.
Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah.
They don't really stack up.
No, they're not on the same level as the rest of us. No way. Not definitely not.
Rank your top 5 Denis Villeneuve.
I am definitely the worst person to be talking about this because I've only seen 4, and one of them isn't Sicario. So that's a sin. I need to see that. I know. So with that being the case, maybe a little recency bias, but I put Dune 2 at number 1, then Prisoners.
Wow, that's big for you.
Then Dune. Yeah, I know. It's there might be recency bias, but and then Blade Runner 2049. Those are the only 4 that I've seen. I'm sure Sicario will be the one I see, and I'm sure it'll get right into this group. But yes, you know how much I love Prisoners, but Dune 2 was just, it's just blown away. But anyways, where about you?
Yeah, Dune 2 comes in 3. You know, it's kind of tough. I like Sicario and Prisoners more, barely more. But I think Sicario, I can go back and rewatch it anytime. It's like such a good movie for being so heavy. Prisoners, again, very heavy. Can't really watch it all that much, but great performances inside and out. Dune 2 is like right up there for me. I loved Arrival. If you got like a snowy or rainy weekend coming up with the missus, going through Arrival, Enemy, and Sicario, that would be like a nice little weekend there. Because Enemy is really good too. I think I might have recommended that before with Jake Gyllenhaal. He has someone that he finds out who looks exactly like him, and then they kind of like trade places, and then
that rings all, a bell now.
All insanity kind of breaks loose there. Mm-hmm. And then I like Blade Runner 2049, but it's you know at the bottom of the list there.
Okay, yeah, I got to see these 3. I didn't know. I remember you bringing up Enemy now after you went through some of that detail. But every time
Arrival's great too. The wife watched Arrival on her own. And I'd seen it previously, and she was completely hooked on that too. So that's another really good one.
Okay. Nice. Yeah, I mean, it seems like this guy's one of the best of the best, right? And that only makes me question more, why the fuck was this a debate? Like, Dune is like this legendary story, and I know they botched it in the 80s, but also that was in the 80s. Cinema's come a long way, like, for various reasons. Fine, you want to wait after the first Dune, but once you're like, oh, we're doing the second one, like, how are you not doing the third right away, off the rip?
Yeah, no, I like, maybe it's just like they don't want to be rushed, or he doesn't want to be rushed, you know, like,
that's fair
with getting, you know, turning stuff out for the sake of, you know, the bottom line, getting maximizing your dollars and stuff. But
that's very true, because if he didn't want to keep going, then you can't do it, because he's like such an important part in all this.
And from what I understand, this has been like a passion project for Denis Villeneuve there. Some of the reviews that I listened to were talking about how he's been like storyboarding Dune Part 1 and Part 2 for like 10 years, just something that like what he would do if he were to be director, and then has taken this on. So, you know, that's always nice to hear from a creator.
Yeah.
Especially when it's like your preferred IP, like, all right, this guy cares as much as I do about it, you know?
Yeah. That's some serious manifestation. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. But right now, I mean, again, we're talking those five movies, you know, the top five Denis Villeneuve movies, and then Enemy and Blade Runner 2049. I mean, you're talking about like a Pedro Martinez late 90s, early 2000s type of run. You know, like that's high heat he's throwing.
Yeah, 100%. It's I saw at some point along the way, like all the Rotten Tomato scores came out, like were like shared, like of all his movies, and it might have been Prisoners. That there's one of them that was on my list. It must have been Prisoners. That was like in the 70s or like high 60s, and I was like, what the fuck? Like,
yeah.
First of all, that's wrong. Second of all, that's where, like, if that's his worst movie, then like, what am I doing? I need to see all this other shit.
And it's interesting because this movie, like, you know, you talk about like the must-see directors, you know, when they put a movie out, you got to go out and see it in the first couple weekends. He's one of them. Christopher Nolan's obviously the other one. And it would have been interesting because Dune 2 is supposed to come out in November, which would have lined it up for this year's Oscars, which I think is happening this week, or next week, or the Sunday, whatever you want to call it. So it would have been interesting to see this up against Oppenheimer and who would have won out in some of these cinematographies, some of these best supporting actors, best picture, best director. Huh. You know, so that would have been interesting to see. But it's also cool in the sense that each of them kind of get their moment. And I think they've gone back and forth and kind of like patted each other on the back saying, oh, I loved Oppenheimer. Oh, I love Dune too. And they can kind of like build each other up, you know, which is fine.
I wonder if that was deliberate, not on Villeneuve's part, but just like
the studio. Maybe.
Yeah. Because I'm not saying this is what should happen, but if I was to bet on it, I would bet that like anytime they're going head to head, like 9 times out of 10, the nod's going to go to Oppenheimer because this is sci-fi. And I know that sci-fi gets more respect than it used to, but it still doesn't get respected in the same way as an Oppenheimer type movie would.
Yeah. Well, we'll never know, I guess. I guess we'll never know. What was the most rewatchable scene?
I mean, Paul versus Fade Rotha was, I feel like I'm overly nitpicky about a few things in when it comes to like entertainment. One of them is how Gambit is portrayed and written, whether it's in comics or in film or anything like that. The other is like one-on-one fights. I feel like I have a tendency to be overly underwhelmed, like more so than most,
given your martial arts experience.
Of course, yes. Yeah. But I just, certain things just don't do it for me as much, and I don't know why. I'm not saying it's reasonable, I just know that about myself. But like, that's why the stuff from Shang-Chi really knocked my socks off. Then this fight with Paul and Fade Rotha, I was like, oh, like, okay, they're gonna do this, all right, here we go, how's this gonna look? And then it was like, whoa, that was some crazy shit. That whole fight sequence was outstanding. I was on the edge of my seat the whole time.
Yeah, and I think the buildup of that moment, not even just the action behind it, but knowing that you have Fade Rotha kind of lurking around the outside of the circle, and he's like eyeing up Paul from the moment that he steps into the, I guess, congregation room, meeting room, or whatever. And they're, you know, almost like mirror opposites of each other. You know, the Bene Gesserit were both kind of eyeing them to be the next for the throne. They're both kind of young up-and-comers trying to make a name for themselves. One represents kind of a passion and life, and the other one kind of represents like pain and masochism and everything. So they're kind of like a yin and yang to each other. And even just like in the how they're represented, right? The black and white of Fade Rotha, and then there's more color and like detail, I guess, life. Yeah, that in Paul there, whether it's with his eyes or like the hair and everything else to it. So I thought they were that was a really well, I guess, built up fight scene to that and everything around it. You knew the Emperor was gonna, you know, call on Fade Rotha to be his champion.
100%. And even though you know that's going to happen, and you know, like, you have a pretty good idea of where this fight's going to go, or, like, at least the final result, I still, even knowing that, I was still very much impressed. Because I think that's an easy thing that can get taken away from good hand-to-hand fights. Like, you know who's going to win. But an easy way to make it better is when you don't know, like when it's like the person you don't expect to win. But in this case, like the person you expect to win does. And I was loving every second of it.
Yeah. And that's the interesting thing about that this movie kind of touches on. And we could talk about this maybe at a different point in time. But, you know, whether you should be rooting for Paul or not, he's not really the hero. And like when he accepts that, finally accepts the Messiah role, which I think is one of the probably the standout moment for me in the movie when he's at that the Southern Fundamentalist Church of the Freemen there, and he goes and finally wins them over. You know, he just finds out that he is part Harkonnen through his mother, and he's like, I'm gonna channel the Harkonnen side of this here, and just kind of easy. I'm gonna go full Harkonnen, and this is like his heel turn almost, that he's going evil and kind of playing into that role a little bit more. And it's all just kind of an act, and he does it so well. And then he does, you know, his close up magic tricks and starts like reading people's minds and shit, and immediately wins everyone over there. But to see that moment, one from a character standpoint of Paul Atreides, but also from the Timothy Chalamet standpoint that we were just talking about before we started recording, of like, all right, I can accept him as the young prince who is promised and the up-and-comer in Dune Part 1. I can see him as the reluctant leader who is seeking out revenge that happens at the end of Dune 1 and at the start of Dune Part 2. But I don't know if I could really see him as a leader of men just because of his stature. I mean, the guy is 5'7". He looks very young. He's got a pretty boy face. So I was waiting if that was going to hit for me and whether I was going to be like, I don't buy it. But that moment came and you completely buy it. You're completely won over by him. And I'm ready to join the cult. You know, I'm ready to go to war with him.
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what you said. And it kind of like dips into, some of what I have for what will age the best. So I'll save that for later. But on the note of the Messiah role specifically, any speech from Paul, like as he starts getting going, as he like finds his voice and learns to speak from his chest, it's just, I'm blown away by how impactful it was for me, because I feel pretty similarly about Timothy Chalamet. At least I did. You know, that has changed. But one of the other things too that I don't think falls under speech, but still like kind of along those lines, when he chirped the Bene Gesserit.
Using the voice. Yeah,
using the voice. I was like, oh fuck! Like,
you're an abomination.
He did an awesome job. It's just great stuff across the board from Timothy Chalamet. But yes, his speeches in that Messiah, like taking on that he did an outstanding job.
Yeah. From the moment that he drinks the water of life, right? That's when he becomes like, it looks like he's looks a little taller. Like they start shooting him from, you know, below, looking up a little bit more to give him that kind of like hero look. So, but again, he's like so tiny and small. But the way that the camera work, it makes him look a little bit bigger. Everything that he says from that point forward is direct. He's not kind of wishy-washy. He's very assertive and knows what he wants and knows how to get it done. And he's not afraid of, you know, any repercussions that come of it, because he's just fully accepting it now, which, again, that's what you want out of a leader, someone who, right or wrong, is, you know, 10 toes down into what they're doing, you know?
Yeah, and I'm just kind of stunned by and large by that. Just I just didn't know that Timothée Chalamet had that level of that like character in his that he had it in him.
Yeah. He's got a couple of tools in the toolkit there that he threw out there. You mentioned the Paul versus Fade Rotha fight, but I think my favorite moment with Fade Rotha was his introduction. On his birthday there, just that whole scene, you get monochrome, black and white, which is such a cool way to depict the Harkonnen homeland. And you get these like ink blot fireworks that pop up there, you know, over top, yeah. And it looks so cool. But you see how crazy it is. You know, you get that memeable scene with him sticking his tongue out and testing the sharpness of the blade before he just like, without thought, just guts two women, you know, like very quickly. He's like, let me try out this blade, bop, 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 and then like slices another girl's throat. And he's got these like concubines that he keeps too that like feed off of other Harkonnen body parts, which was, I thought, was kind of an interesting note there.
Yeah, so that's right.
That whole scene was just very freaky. And then the fight, which I was a little confused about, but I liked it, you know, the gladiator battle. So it's like, is this just for his birthday celebration? This is kind of like an unanswerable question, but like, is it just for his birthday celebration, or do they all get together and just watch him beat up drunkenly drugged up prisoners all the time while he has a shield on?
Yeah, that's definitely an unanswerable one. But maybe if we read the books, we would know. But
yeah,
I'm guessing it's normally a gladiator type situation, and this is supposed to be like a foul fake. Sorry, I gotta stop doing the French stuff. A fake, gladiator stuff. Gladiator fight, kind of.
It could be. It could have been that there, but I was a little thrown off. I was like, I wonder what this usually is with him. Like, or is it just like the birthday celebration? And these are a couple bones getting thrown his way. And then, you know, the cool thing is you get Baron Harkonnen, you know, not drugging one of them. And it was one of the last Atreides lines there. So he gets a little bit of a fight just to kind of test his mettle and see what he's made of. And Fade Rotha answers the call. And then he ends up getting to be the governor, I guess, of Arrakis. How about the first spiced harvest raid?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was like the first real fight scene that you see. And it was after, you know, the Harkonnen soldiers went to seek out Jessica and Paul and everyone else there. And they kind of have that little, like, the scene with the jetpack and stuff. I thought that was really cool with the Harkonnens. But right after that, when that's the first raid where you have Paul and Chani using the rocket launcher, and they're hiding underneath the legs of the spice machine, the spice harvester. Very, very cool stuff and how they time it out. And then you see some cool interaction between, you know, Paul and Chani and that kind of relationship building, which is, you know, you get for probably the first half, maybe the first third of the movie.
Yeah, I'm just now thinking about like the jetpacks, because I never, like, it's just
jetpacks were so cool. It was like dead silent. The whole theater goes silent at that point. So,
yeah,
you know, you're getting like overloaded with Hans Zimmer scores like left and right. And then all of a sudden you get silence and they just kind of float up like very, very smoothly to the top of the rocks.
Yeah, that was I don't know if like that's a book or a Villain Away choice, but that was some pretty cool shit. Like, it just felt like they just turned off the gravity for that. So it was just interesting choice.
But the reality is, like, this whole movie, I feel like, is very rewatchable to me, much like you could say about Empire Strikes Back or The Two Towers or The Dark Knight. Like, this is the movie that I think everyone's returning to more so than the first one, just because of it's a complete movie.
Yeah, I do feel I do agree with that by and large. But the Two Towers note is, I saw somebody tweet, I think it was tweeting about it, somebody was saying how like it's like it doesn't get as much love as the first one and the third one from Lord of the Rings. And I was like, I feel like the average person likes, like, the average like person who liked Lord of the Rings movies, not like loved it or whatever, like liked it, the second one's their favorite one.
Yeah, I thought the Return of the King got so much love at the Oscars was because the overall assumption that they got robbed out of the Two Towers. The Two Towers was the better film, but it was more like an award for the entire body of work, or like a makeup.
And that may be it. I love three. I'm not saying two is my favorite necessarily. I think one gets a ton of disrespect now. Like I've rewatched it a few times over the last few years. But yeah, I just needed to bring that up because I was like, I'm not crazy, right? Like again, not saying two is my favorite, but
yeah,
that most people say that it is their favorite.
Yeah, I think most people would say that it's, you know, maybe the best of the three, maybe less than the personal favorite, but just like objectively. But I don't know, to each their own. What will age the best from this movie?
I think the final fight scene ages well. We've already talked about that a ton. I don't know how much Stellan Skarsgård has played the villain over the years, but I need more of it. And if I've missed out on some of it, then I need to be informed of where I haven't been looking because he's so good. I mean, in the first one, he was good. In this one, I was just like, God, he's like this revolting, like bulbous figure that's like floating through the air. And every part of me wants to kind of it's just such a huge turnoff for me. Like, I just don't want to care about that character, but he's so fucking good at being an asshole.
But you know, I would have thought I thought he had a bigger role in the first one. I thought he was great. And I thought the Harkonnens again are just as a whole, as a family unit are just a great villain to go up against.
Yes.
But I thought he was kind of neutralized here and you see more of Fade Rotha. You see more of a Beast Rabin here, but in the first one, he has this like looming presence, and because almost like Thanos in the sense where he doesn't really say a lot, you don't really see him a whole lot, but you feel that big presence that he has. And he's got these really creepy scenes, like his head coming out of what looks like oil and stuff like that. So I thought he was more imposing in the first one than the second one, but yeah, he's great in both. Great in both.
Yeah, I just need more of him as the bad guy. He can play. I know, like in the scheme of all this, I guess the Harkonnens, they played their role, but they were pretty big. They were big bads in that first movie, and he can do that again. I alluded to this already, but like, what's going to age the best from this movie? My view of Timothée Chalamet. Just I was watching this, and I'm like, there was a point in the movie where I was like, I'm enjoying this, but I'm not a Chalamet guy. And I know this character is well written. And I know it's like he's doing a good job, but it's not like there's something that's missing for me. I just don't like, I don't know if it's going to get there, like to that full level for me. It's almost as if I said that and then everything fucking changed, because it was just like you have this steady build with this character and then he takes off in like the third act. And I'm still blown away because we've seen, you know, character development and, you know, like that's impressive over the years within, you know, in various movies. But I feel like I've never been so impressed by the character, the development of one main character in an individual movie as I was this one.
There's a lot of, I agree. He grows a lot through there. And you can see, this was interesting because, you know, Denis Villeneuve was saying that he doesn't really like dialogue in movies. And that's what ruins movies. I think he was saying that in like an interview, press junket situation. And it's great. What's great about Blade Runner 2049 and even Arrival, this movie, is that you get so much is said through facial expressions and close-ups of the actors, and that you kind of see, like with Chani, for instance, like her physically torn over what's happening to Paul as being this fake messiah, right? And his reluctance to accept it, but he ends up doing it, and you can see how hurt she is because she loves him, but she also knows that this is like everything that she stands against. And you can kind of really see that on her face. I think the same could be said for Chalamet, whether he's talking to his mother or how he's kind of working the entire Freeman to get on his side and slowly win them over. I think you see a lot of that in just like the physical acting of it, which I think goes a long way.
Yeah, I think there's something to, because when he said that, I was like, well, wait, what do you mean by that? But
Just listen to Madam Web.
Yeah. But then as you go and watch this and as you're breaking it down, it's like, well, if you just make, if you just utilize the dialogue only when you absolutely have to utilize it, then it's going to be as effective as it possibly can be. And I think this movie, while there's a fair amount of dialogue in it, of course, like it's like what you said, like you have that end, that late scene where you have Florence Pugh, Timothy Chalamet, and Zendaya standing at the end, and it's just like, you fucked up, dude. And like, this is weird. And like, now it's uncomfortable. Like, so much is there in that moment. But is it little said or nothing said? I think it's nothing is said in that moment, right?
Very little. And it's like, yeah, this is kind of like basic stuff. But she, you know, Chani is standing behind Paul, and then Princess Irulan is standing in front of him, representing the future. She's representing the past and what he's moving on to. So you get all that there. Again, you can see it all. It's very well done. And again, for an idiot like myself to be able to pick up on that and still kind of like add into that moment, that subtle subtext, again, without really saying anything, it speaks volumes.
Yeah, this is like, as you and I are talking about it more and more, this feels like one of those kind of movies that like film classes will utilize. Like,
I can see that. Yeah, for sure.
There's just so much. There's so much that's well done about it.
Well, yeah, and on that note, I think the cinematography. Greg Fraser was the director of cinematography there. He's done the Batman. He's done a couple of other things. Dune Part One. So I mean, the scale of everything is great. I mean, to be able to take in the sheer size of the sandworms in relation to the humans, and be able to show that on a great, you know, on awesome level. Same thing with the ships and the machinery in relation to the people. And you get these like long scenes that kind of like establish the setting, these establishing shots. It's amazing. Everything works out great. The sun, like when you think about that, the 1v1 fight with Fade Ratha and Paul, the sun is setting behind them. So you get the shadow on them at a certain point. So you just have the desert sun kind of illuminating the whole room. And then they're the shadows kind of fighting. Again, very, very great work. So shout out to Greg Fraser. And then, of course, the great Hans Zimmer on the score. All those things make up and add to the conversation without having dialogue once again. So yeah. All those things kind of go a long way. And when you have someone as great as Hans Zimmer and Greg Fraser who can help build that up there, then you don't have to have as good of a script.
Yeah.
And really, like you said, this pretty simple story. This not much, even though – you know, you could say, you know, everyone has copied Dune, whether that's 100%. Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, but the Star Wars story is very simple, much like this story is very simple. Yeah, you know, there's not a lot going on to it. You know, it's you know, family tribes, family political, you know, big family political groups fighting over power. And the fallout from that. And then you got a love story. And then some of them is the families are actually closer than they think. And then there's betrayal and all. So it's like your typical hero story, but it's just done very well. So yeah, everything, you don't really poke at the story too much, or, you know, at the simplicity of it, because right. Everything else is done so well.
Yeah. And on the, and while like anybody who reads Dune, like you said it, Wes, like it they did it first. It's like, well, you know, unfortunately for them, because they're like one of the, like in the scheme of all these other movies, like they're one of the last ones to get made. It's like, well, tough. Like, yeah. Sure. Like you can, when you're talking about literature, maybe that's different because like you can judge it differently because that was like, it came out is it the 60s or something?
I think 65, I think. Yeah.
So there you go. We're not like if the great movie like Star Wars, if it was made like and it was well regarded in the 70s, then yeah, okay, then we'd look at it differently and we'd allow for certain things because it was made then. But now it's like, no, it's made now and it's reaching everybody at a different point in time. So it's kind of like tough shit. You gotta show up and they have. And you know, you bring up the cinematography, and obviously that goes without saying, 100%, you're spot on with everything you said. But then the score too, it's just like it blows my mind just like thinking about like how much of a difference the music on a movie makes. Like when you have Villeneuve saying, oh yeah, like I like dialogue doesn't do as much. Like there's so many other things besides the dialogue in just the script in general. But whether you're talking about like, you know, score, like in a Hans Zimmer style, or if you're talking about just like having like music of the time of that moment, in the mix,
so like a Guardians type thing as like the opposite end of the spectrum, right?
Yeah, it's crazy how mm-hmm. much it can elevate that movie, because it just make, like, in different ways, you're like, I'm having a good time. Like, this music is like getting me in the right mood.
I'm right there with you. This is one of my favorite twists of the movie. The reveal of Paul and Jessica being Harkonnens. Yeah. Did not see that coming. I was like, whoa, shit. All right. Okay. Now we're here for it. And then you get the great line at the end where he's like, you know, now it's my time to kill you, grandfather, or whatever he says, the grandfather. And then he stabs Harkonnen in the neck.
Yeah, actually, and I didn't think about it when I was watching the movie, and that's great. But, like, again, when we talk about, like, thrones in Star Wars, like, getting stuff from this, it's like...
Luke, I'm your father, right?
Like, Luke, I'm your father, and Jon Snow is a Targaryen.
Yeah, the prince who was promised. Yeah, absolutely. Who lost his whole family, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Bene Gesserit, I love this group. I remember talking about them in Dune Part 1. It's just, like, a great... faction in this, and then as you see more of their political webs that they spin around everyone to kind of make sure that they're in control. Very interesting that it's, you know, all kind of women witches who, you know, aren't allowed. This is a patriarchal world, it seems like, so they're not really allowed in the decision making, but they are pulling all the strings from behind the scenes. So they are the marionette. What's the guy who holds the marionette? The puppeteer, of everything there. So I thought that was great. Again, I loved her performance in the first one, but what's her name there? Reverend Mother Moyham. Unbelievable. Awesome.
She's great. And when Jessica claps back at her, it was like, oh.
Yeah.
She's crazy. Lady Jessica's awesome. Like, she's fucking.
And she goes off her rocker there a little bit movie too, which is very cool to see. How about, I mentioned this to Harkonnens as a worthy villain. They're all crazy, wild, seemingly representing, the Third Reich, kind of a Hitler German army, maybe Russian Soviet influences in there. Mm. You can see all that stuff, and that they certainly fit the part. This is some minor stuff. The atomic stockpile that Gurney Harkonnen found. Very cool. I would love just to have an atomic stockpile at my will, just like hidden somewhere. That would be cool to have. Good ace in the sleeve there. And then the last thing, the Fremen's guerrilla tactics, unbelievable. Oh, yeah. They're built up as these great fighters by Duncan Idaho in the first one there. But you don't really see it too much. And this time we really get to see it, and they're like unstoppable, right? And they have the land in their favor. They know the whole terrain. This could be alluded to the guerrilla tactics of the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, and the Vietnam War, why they were so effective, or, you know, the Afghans when the Soviet Russia invaded, or when America invaded in Iraq and Afghanistan, the problems that they gave those huge armed forces, you know, established armed forces of like Russia and the United States. And these small local groups with like next to nothing, you know, by comparison, were able to kind of put up some good numbers against them.
Them popping out of the sand is awesome. So is so cool. Like, and I should have cited that earlier, but I absolutely love that. Yeah.
And just the overall resourcefulness of the Fremen, you know, I think it's cool. They drain all the fluids from the dead bodies there. And
that's like, something.
That's pretty gross, but you know, everything about that, you know, taking the burning or the dead bodies and then porting that into their sacred pool, sacred river, whatever that is at their home base. Very, very resourceful. So I love that. What do you think will age the worst? Anything?
Paul accepting his messiah role.
It's probably not going to turn out too well for him. I mean, he saw the visions, right? So he knows what's happening, but he's doing it anyway.
Yes.
And this is the interesting thing, because, you know, there's the idea of him being the messiah, but that's all propaganda that Chani, you know, recognizes of the Bene Gesserit so that they can get their,
yes,
the desired outcome that they want.
That was great. I loved that. Yeah, that was great.
So it's, again, like you're watching this movie, like almost as part of the Fremen, and you want to root for Atreides to rise and to kind of take on that messiah role. But you also know that this means, again, probably bad stuff for the Fremen, just having another, master ownership over them.
Yeah.
And then clearly a holy war is never good, right. You know, for anyone in the long run. So like, that's, yeah, I agree.
Yeah, that was such like when she said that, I was like that when she called that out, though, I was like, it just was like, oh, that makes that scratches an itch just for some reason for me. And I thought that was such a nice little twist. And I'm assuming like that's from the books. It's just such a nice detail in all of this. Like, just really brings it all together. But yeah, so it's I haven't read the books, like I've said, but I just saw stuff right away on Twitter. It's like, yeah, people love Paul now, but
yeah.
Oh, we'll okay.
See.
Okay.
This was like a personal thing, very minor. I was very, anxiety inducing moments watching Jessica being pregnant in the desert, much like in the first one towards the end. Just did not feel comfortable throughout that whole situation. She's like bashing dudes' heads in with a rock. She's going traversing the desert. She's got a bait. I don't know how much she's eating, you know, like all that kind of stuff. And especially so with the water of life scene with her, when you see that water kind of like mix in with the fetus, it was very off-putting to me. I kind of cringed inside because I'm like, what's happening to this baby?
You guys don't do that too?
Yeah. We do that just with hard alcohol. It's get some vodka mixing in there for you know. But yeah, so all that was very uneasy. But I do love the idea of not using, I think it's Aliyah, Anya Taylor-Joy, you know, what ends up being Paul's sister. Because I believe in the David Lynch 80s movie, she's born and is a toddler in the second movie, or what's depicted in this part.
Well, yeah, we'll probably see her in the next one. But
yeah, for sure. But I love the idea of her not being born. One, using that as a time frame device, as I was so lost in our last show that we watched, True Detective Night Country. Having Jessica be pregnant throughout, it's like, okay, so we're only a couple months here, 3 more months here. And by the end, she's like about ready to give birth, it feels like, you know?
Yeah.
Right at the 7, 8, 9 month.
Well, she's talking to the baby, which you didn't cite that being a problem. So you're okay with her.
No, I love that. I thought that was great. That was a great use to keep her involved and then be able to show the power of the water of life and like just how unhinged Jessica's become, because you could look at it as probably as what it was, as the fetus is gaining all the knowledge that she is gaining from the past lives and everything like that. So now she's her mind's awakened prematurely, but it could also show like the craziness that Jessica delves into by taking on the water of life, how she's kind of like this crazy witch doctor now. Mm-hmm. So I think it kind of works both ways, where she's saying, speaking in wheeze, or you know, she wants to know this, and it's just a creepy way to kind of convey, again, being like a witch doctor essentially. Mm-hmm.
And it's really, again, another thing that's just well done, because like that's a not having been not being a father yet, that is a normal thing for like the mother to talk to the kid in some capacity, right?
Yeah, but not for the kid to talk back, though.
Exactly. Yeah. And like the baby wants, like when you want to do something, like want to eat something, like the baby wants this or whatever. Like that's, but like you said, she's talking in wheeze, and it's just like, and I get it, you got the other person in you, but it's just like the way they did it, it's just, they took this like normal thing and made it like, oh, this ain't,
yeah,
right.
It's a little like unnerving. Yeah, yeah. I agree. I thought that was very well done. But this is the What Age the Worst Person version, I should say. This is, I guess, kind of like an unanswerable question, but if you're the Fremen, what better way to honor the dead than to bring Arrakis back to life with all of the water from the past souls?
Yeah, but how the hell are you going to do that?
I don't know. You could create some sort of... They created suits that take the sweat and the water that you produce from your body, then filter it, and then make it drinkable. You know, they're a pretty resourceful group. Like, I got to imagine there's an irrigation way that you can set up, because like when Skillgard shows Lady Jessica that, she's like, this is thousands and thousands of gallons of water, and he's like, yeah, it could bring, you know, lush life back to Arrakis. And I'm like, isn't that the way to honor, you know, to the dead to honor the living and vice versa? But I don't know.
I mean, maybe I don't see how they can do that, and B, I think that their faith is more powerful than that. So there you go. And look at, they got their Messiah in the end.
Did they, though? Did they?
You sure about that?
Again, minor thing here. Having Florence Pugh and Lea Seydoux cast in similar roles, especially when their like face is kind of shrouded half the time, I'm like, wait, who is seducing Fade Rotha here? You know, and it took me a couple minutes, but they look similar.
Mm-hmm. They do look similar. I'm sorry, I'm laughing because I'm having like a moment of like I would just like maybe a series of YouTube videos or something where someone just puts Tim Robinson in all these moments where it's like people are excited about this thing, like, you know, you're, oh, we're happy about Paul like making his ascension, and then it's like, you sure about that? it's just maybe a 2 minute video of like clips like that where he just randomly he's inserted into Arrakis and other places
It should be like in famous historical moments. So like,
yes, that too.
You know, something like JFK would be like, you know, just before his Dallas trip, he's like, I can't wait to be in Dallas. And it's like, you sure about that? Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. Just a whole series of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I like that. I like anyways, your headset there.
But Florence Pugh and Lea Seydoux. Yes. That just one's the one that kind of went past me quickly, but yeah.
Can you effectively kiss with no nose tubes in?
You know what? I will try to figure that out for you. I don't know.
Cause I was wondering, because they're kind of on, you know, they wear them on the same side. So when they're facing each other, they're kind of each going opposite ways. Right. But it's got to get in the way when you're kissing.
I think it's only when you start using the tongue.
But it could be, I don't know. Maybe there's some sort of sand kissing that I don't know about.
Oh, there you go.
Who had the best performance by a side character?
There's a lot of good ones in here.
Filled with great side. It's tough.
I know you said Baron Harkonnen, you know, just in general, the Harkonnens that weren't named Fade Rotha weren't utilized as much, but I still thought like his slugging percentage was outstanding. Sure. He just didn't get a whole lot of at bats. It's kind of like Matt Stairs, I guess is the best way to put it.
Oh, there we go. I like that. He's another hefty guy.
Yep. Stilgar was obviously awesome. Some may say he's also part of the problem, but he's great either way.
He offered like the comedic relief in this with how much he bought into the lease on Al Ghib. It was great. Everything that Paul did, he's like, it was prophesied this. He's doing, you know, and he just how much he bought in. But I think there was a little bit of a character shift between him and Beast Raban there, between the first movies and the second one, where in the first one, Stilgar seems like very strong, maybe like has a quiet confidence, you know, kind of stoic, and you don't really see too much of him and skeptical. And this one, he's like more outspoken and like not braggadocious, but like extroverted. He's more animated. He's a little bit more humorous, which I didn't have a problem either way with him, but it just seemed like that was a big shift. In the same way with Beast Raban, where he seemed really formidable in the first one, and then in part two you find out he's kind of like a child.
It was a tough go for Beast Raban for sure. With Stilgar, I mean, the biggest thing for me is like I just love Javier Bardem. Like just I haven't seen everything he's in, but anything I've seen him in, I've enjoyed his performance. I think he does an amazing job. Lady Agreed. Jessica was a great side character as well. Mm-hmm. We already talked about all her wildness. And I know we've talked about him a ton, but Fade Rotha, he's the number one for sure. I mean, he was just everything he did is awesome. And he's still not like as much as he's at center stage, he's not like getting the same kind of screen time as Zendaya or as Timothy Chalamet necessarily.
Yeah, I thought the Austin Butler did a great job. He might be like, again, like the biggest takeaway from it. You know, of the side characters, but again, you mentioned Stilgar, I thought Lady Jessica did a great job. I love Rebecca Ferguson as an actress. And seeing you talk about the growth of Paul throughout this movie in a pretty quick fashion, you see that shift in Lady Jessica. I mean, the moment that she becomes the Reverend Mother of the Freeman, she's no longer really Paul's mother.
Yeah,
you know, and I think that's even referenced by a couple people. Like, you're losing your mother or something.
Yeah,
something
he's about to lose effect. His mother. But yeah, go easy on him. Yeah, all that stuff.
Yeah, but to see her go and then to see how she is really evil, right? She says something along the lines of like, "Let me go. We must attack the weakest first, So to get the true believers, and then you work your way down to the South, to the fundamentalists, and then you can convince them. So she's really, you know, pretty maniacal and pathological in her efforts. And you start to see that kind of rub off a little bit, or, you know, Paul becomes more open to that idea and accepting of that idea as the movie unfolds.
You know, the bringing up the point of how, like, he's about to lose his mother is really interesting, because I thought that I only took it in the literal sense of, like, she's about to die because that drink's supposed to be poisonous and everything like that. But it is very much in that moment meant in the literal sense. But I'm sure this was, like, a specific detail from the book that's like, no. He's like, no matter what happens, even
she's
if she's
never going to be the same.
Yeah. That ain't his mom no more. Cause she's taken on, like, all the other Reverend mothers, like all the knowledge that they have from the past. So how can you be the same person? So yeah, that's an interesting, I didn't think about it like that, but yeah, she was great. She'd be she's number two to Fade Rotha, but like a really strong number two.
Mm-hmm. And I love Gurney Halleck, you know, like getting Josh Brolin back in the mix. I think that was great. I think his, once he appears back into Paul's life, you can see him become more accepting. He's reminded of the Atreides family a little bit more. Gurney kind of pushes him to kind of accept that leadership role and kind of take it on and not like push against it so much. Right. So everything kind of accelerates when Gurney shows back up. And again, I love seeing like the hard ass, but who really has a heart of gold. And like that's Gurney Halleck, you know? So I thought that was great. Excuse me. And lastly, honorable mention, shout out to the sandworms. Didn't get a whole lot of sandworm action in the first one here, but they're prominently featured. Very cool. I mean, riding the sandworms, very cool stuff.
They got their own fucking buckets.
Yeah, they got their own buckets. That's true. That's true. But
they got their dough.
They're essentially like Uber systems, like Uber pools.
Sure. Yeah.
Maybe like a train. Maybe a train would be a better approach,
like,
comparison.
Better Sarlacc pits.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah. Almost like the same thing. You know? Or, yeah.
Boba Fett. Anyways. Yeah.
Yeah. And then Mother Moyham, Reverend Mother Moyham. Also a big fan of her. But Fade Rotha, you know, I feel like this was the toughest category because there are so many great performances. But Fade Rotha gets it. Who lost the movie?
The Harkonnens.
But so you say the Harkonnens overall.
Yeah.
And they ask because Paul Atreides is a Harkonnen.
This is true. I guess we'll say shit.
The bald boys.
Yeah. I'm trying to aren't Beast and Fade Rotha, they're brothers, right?
Yeah, they're brothers, but they're nephews of Baron Harkonnen.
Right.
I don't think they were sons. Yeah.
Right. So we'll just, the brothers Harkonnen, like whatever, like that line, like they lose. How's that?
That's true. That line's off. Yeah. I mean, Beast Rabban was my big loser of this, just from the standpoint of what I said, looking so formidable in the first one, and then really being exposed as like a child petulant, you know,
tantrum
thrower.
He has the tantrums. He gets worked by Josh Brolin. It's payback, obviously, for what happened before. But as you're saying all this, I just remembered, like, he saw Paul. Like, I know he didn't know.
He ran back scared, yeah.
I don't think he knew it was Paul. He just knew it was, like, this is the figure. Mm-hmm. But, like, yeah, he ran back scared. Like, didn't even try to put up a fight. Whereas, like, I know Fade Rotha knew who he was fighting in that moment and everything. But I think Fade Rotha would have tried to at least put up a fight with that
Paul in that moment. He seems more willing to seize the moment than Beast Rabban, obviously.
Yeah. Seems like Beast is probably like the older sibling who like had things always kind of work out for him. But then like the second he hits like real adversity, it's like, oh, like he's like that. He's the kid. No, this is what he is. He's the kid who like in eighth grade was like 6 foot before everybody else was.
and then he
gets to high school and then he doesn't grow a fucking inch. And then it's like, oh, I used to be the Beast. And now I'm just like, now I got to face real adversity. I'm still 6 feet tall. Like, what the fuck?
Born on third base, kid thinks he hit a triple, right?
Yep.
Chani's another big loser. Although I thought Zendaya's performance was great.
Yep.
Although she's like kind of getting typecast a little bit in these roles where she's like plays a kind of a skeptic hard ass to begin with, who was really, you know, kind of a softie on the inside, and she's like quirky but cute. Yeah, I'm seeing that was kind of her role in Euphoria. It was definitely her role in the Spider-Man trilogies. So it's kind of interesting. She's really just playing herself. You know, you could probably say the same to a lesser extent of Timothée Chalamet, but it works. Again, you get all that physical emotion from her, the physical acting of being able to show her confliction between being in love with Paul Atreides, but knowing that he's going down the wrong path. And all of that stuff. So she does a great job of it, but I couldn't help but thinking that this is just Zendaya in the movie.
I can see the thread between this and her MJ. I can't see it in the same way with what is it? What's her character's name in Euphoria again?
Rue.
Rue. Okay. Yeah. I can't see it in that. Are we ever going to get another season of that, by the way?
I don't know. I think that showrunner was in a little bit of hot water. I don't think the cast liked him. I think they said they worked him too hard or something like that.
Oh, geez. Okay. Well, I mean, that was a wild show. So that's actually not stunning.
It's true. Yeah.
But anyways, I can't see that thread with her in this one necessarily, but I do think that's a fair claim that like she lost the movie. Although you could also argue that, well, no, she could end up being the big winner next go around.
She could, but we still got to wait for that to unfold. I can certainly see her coming back and then being, the Maib or the Lison Al Gaib for the Fremen, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe she's not in. I don't know if she's in the mix. Like neither of us know. Like doing the lore
with how it ended with her looking back, and it's like it's clear that she's going on her own path. I can't imagine that she would not be involved. Her character in the third one.
We'll see. Yeah. You sure about that?
Yeah, I'm not sure, but that's just how I'm feeling right now. That's you know, reading the tea leaves. I'm trying to.
Mm.
Who won the movie, Nick?
I mean, it's either Timothée Chalamet or Denis Villeneuve. Take your pick. They both did an outstanding job. Mm-hmm. And like, because I think Chalamet was already pretty well respected, and I'm not saying Villeneuve wasn't, but I get the feeling now that if he, like, whatever next big ass budget thing he wants to do, it's just going to be like a blank check. Like, because
yeah, absolutely.
Because, like, as much as, again, like, you know, he still had the book that he was working off of, like, so many, like, there's so many times that, like, the best movies oftentimes are based off of books, whether they be comics or action or prose. But like, I just think whatever, like, to get this, which is like it's in the 60s, so like a 60-year-old story, in an era where, like, people, you can't have blockbusters outside of the MCU, you go and do this in this moment. I just think that he set himself up very nicely for at least his next movie, if not his next couple.
For sure. Yeah, it's Timothée Chalamet for me. And then also just movie theaters. I think between this and then he had Barbenheimer over the summer. I don't know what you saw in your trailers, but I saw this trailer for the Kevin Costner, like American Western, like a epic that's going to be released, I think, like a month apart. It's like a 3-part saga, and they're all going to be released in theaters again, like maybe like 1 month apart from one another.
Huh.
Which I thought was really interesting, but it kind of has like a Yellowstone, like, again, like that, early, yeah, early American, you know, as everything is kind of forming time, frontier. That's the word I was looking for. American frontier.
Gotcha.
The trailer looks great. Again, it has like a Dances with Wolves type of vibe. And that's like right up Kevin Costner's alley. But my thought was, what a great way to combat streaming. And if you're trying to increase people to go to the movie theaters and create more movie going experiences, you have a big American frontier epic that plays out in real time, you know, essentially over like a 3-month period as you're watching it. That keeps you kind of coming back instead of being like, oh, I can binge all of this on Paramount Plus or Netflix or something like that. I think that's an interesting way to try to combat staying at home on your couch.
Yeah, I didn't.
It's creative, in my opinion.
I missed that. I don't know if I feel like I saw the trailer, but I missed that detail.
They might have premiered during the Super Bowl, but I didn't catch it during then.
Gotcha. Well, it's an interesting approach. I mean, it's almost like they're trying, like you said, like trying to, combating streaming services. It's almost in a way like a habit forming type of experience. So,
yeah. So I hope that's the case. And then like everything that I've seen on social media about people's excitement for this movie, going back and seeing it twice, people who didn't really look like sci-fi fans or like, I got my tickets for it. You know, you see this guy riding a scooter that's dressed as a sandworm. So he's like Paul Atreides, like kind of going through the scooter through the movie theater, like very cool stuff. I like that. So that's a good sign for movie theaters.
Yeah. And on that note too, I know when we went to see it, so at the one that we tend to go to, because we usually go to Apple, not so much Chunky's. That's like, just cause it can get a little chaotic there.
A little chunky. Yeah.
At this theater in Merrimack, I have only seen it packed two times. One was when Barbenheimer was going on, and the other time was when Mario came out. Next level, like crazy. This wasn't I walked into the theater and it was like nobody was there. I was like, holy shit, like how is nobody here? Like in the lobby.
Friday night.
Yeah. I get into the theater and then I'm like, there's a few people in here, okay, but there's not a lot. But as it goes along, more and more people start to trickle in, and I was like, okay, all right, this like so it was a full theater in the end, but it like took a second. So I get the timing. It's 6:40, so you know, kind of in the middle of dinner still, whatever.
Sure,
but to get like a full theater at this place, like I just feel like my theater is more for kids for some reason. Mm-hmm. So it was just I adding on to like. More people are coming back. Like it's a legitimate date night movie.
There we go. I like that. That's good stuff there. Okay. So Nick gave it a 97. I gave it a 98. That's a CMM aggregate score of 97.5 for Dune Part 2. So go see it in theaters. Go see it on the biggest screen IMAX if possible. I didn't get an IMAX ticket. I was disappointed about that, but the timing didn't work out. So I just saw it on a regular ass theater and it was still great, but this is much like Oppenheimer is being billed. See this on the biggest screen you can. And I think you'll appreciate that all the more better. Go see Dune Part 2. And with that, let's go check out to the Discharge Depot because the train's leaving the station right now.
Choo-choo bitches.
All right. What'd you do this weekend, Nick?
So we had a very nice, relaxed weekend after like a month of just never being home. And one of the things I decided to do that I just want to bring up because it's timely is that I rewatched The Crow. And of course, we got the pictures of Bill Skarsgård. I forgot that he was taking on this role that they're actually
I as well.
In.
Yeah.
I remember Momoa being rumored in some capacity at one point, but anyways, I was like, I didn't think I was like, is this going to happen? I don't know. Just, you know, obviously movies has been a lot going on in the last few years. And I, on the note of like the look of this character, cause it's like, I saw people saying this, he doesn't like, he looks like the kind of character that the Crow would want to beat up. And I feel bad saying this, but I tend to agree. Like it's
interesting.
And I still want to see this movie. I'm excited to see it, but I'm not like optimistic because in a character where I feel like you're going and misrepresenting him in his look, like right away where he's all tatted up and everything like that. And he's supposed to look like this, like, I don't know, like a gangster in some kind of way, like a bad boy, like a punk. It's like, that's not what this guy was. Like you talk about stories that, like we're talking about stories like I know, I think the Crow was in the 80s, but stories that have like a similar, a simple plot line, like that's all about this one guy who was madly in love with this girl. And then they get targeted, they get taken out and like he wants payback and that's it. Like even in the book, the comic, it's more simple than it is in the Brandon Lee movie. What happens, like why that happens. So it's like, that's what that's about. And now you're like turning him into this, like this punk, I guess. I don't know. Like, I don't want to judge it based on two pictures, but there were a lot of reactions to it. And like, it feels like if you're getting the main character wrong in such an important way, it's not a good sign.
It's not a good first step. I wasn't too big on the Crow like everyone else. I did love the look. I love the paint. I love the Sting adoption of the Crow look in WCW. But yeah, so I don't have too much of a connection to it. If this is something that we want to review, if we want to do like an original versus sequel, be happy to go back and check that out when the time comes. But yeah, that's too bad. I'm sorry you feel that way.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Yes, tough weekend. But what about you? Yeah.
I met up with a couple high school buddies. So, you know, it was four of us in high school. We're all really close. Just let out a little fart there.
That's wow.
But yeah, so we don't really get together all that much. We're all kind of separated. One's in Newport, another's in Warwick, another one's up in Beverly. Two people got two kids each. You know, two of them got two kids each, and the other one's getting married. I just had my first. So, you know, life's crazy. So
sure.
We hadn't all been together in like 10 years or so. So it was nice getting lunch and getting some drinks down in Providence. And the great thing, you know this, people at home know this, if you have, again, old high school, old college buddies that you haven't seen and you wonder like, is it going to be weird? But you just end up picking like right back up where you left off, and like conversation flows, everything's really easy, and it's like you guys like never left. Like that's kind of what it was. So that's always a nice feeling when you get to do that. So hopefully we do that, you know, a little bit more than every 10 years.
Yeah, that's because I know about it's Newport. You said one of your buddies, right?
Yeah.
Golf with him from time to time.
No, that's a different college buddy.
Oh, college.
The one that lives in Newport is tough because he works in the restaurant business.
Oh,
so his time off is when, you know, Monday, Tuesday, you know, when we're starting our work week, and that's like the busiest time of his work week is when we're off. So
yeah, 100%,
you know, trying to get on the same page on top of kids and everything else, is tough.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Never mind. I misremembered. Forget what I was going to say.
No, but it's close. Little Compton, Rhode Island is where we would go.
Oh, gotcha. Mm-hmm, okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I haven't been there in a little while. Anyways. Speaking of like future episodes, though, do you remember what we have next week?
Well, I got it pulled up. We had Avatar: The Last Airbender, but I think we're going to
do Aquaman because it's on HBO Max now.
I was just going to say, we can do that. We have two openings until the original sequel of Roadhouse on March 25th. So March 11th and March 18th, we got two openings. Maybe we do Aquaman, The Lost Kingdom, and then a definitive DCEU rankings the following week.
Look at that. Nice and easy.
How's that sound, huh?
Love it. And we save money along the way.
There we go, right? Now we get to watch it on HBO Max. Thank you for sending along your updated password, Nick, and we can watch it.
You're welcome.
But as always, we'll be back. Same bat time, same bat place.